Marcus Sahaba Online Radio, serving you wherever you are.
4 minutes after 12 p.m. Central African Time. Welcome to the Tuesday edition of the News Hour right here on Marcus Sahaba Online Radio, the voice of Ahl Sunnah Wal Jama'ah. My name is Alpha Simposi. Great honor to be with you this afternoon. And indeed, we are together from now up until 12:55. Of course, wow, it's been a very juicy morning when it comes to news. We look at the Madlanga Commission and the Ad Hoc Committee. Wow. Wow. Very explosive from both sides. Wow. The big question is, what's going to happen at the end? However, what we have in store for you this afternoon, indeed, well, I'm not sure if you know about the No Kings protest that's taking place in the United States of America. Indeed, we're going to look into that and just get some analysis with regards to that particular protest. As we know that over the past week or so, it seems as if some Republican leaders were hoping that Saturday's No Kings demonstrations, the marches and rallies hosted by a coalition of liberal groups across the country and worldwide would turn violent. So the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, called them Hate America rallies, a moniker that was quickly picked up by other Republicans and described the No Kings protest as a crucible of potential riots representing all the pro-Hamas wing. And you know that Antifa people, you're going to bring together what? The Marxists, the socialists, the Antifa advocates, the anarchists, and the pro-Hamas wing of the far-left Democratic Party. Right? Now, the big question is, this massive No Kings protest, will it mark a new American political posture? We look into those analysis with Professor Patrick Bond to help us unpack this and more. And of course, we'll touch base on the developments in Madagascar as well, as we know that there are developments there whereby what I think the African Union decided to say that they are kicking Madagascar out of the compact, whereas the interim leader says, look, we don't care, we'll do our own things. So that's what we're going to dissect in this first segment of the show this afternoon. Stay with us indeed. We speak to Professor Patrick Bond. Well, thank you so much. Good afternoon. Welcome back to the program.
Assalamu alaikum. It's wonderful to be back with you. Oh, thank you.
It's a great pleasure indeed, Prof. I really appreciate you taking time to speak to us, enlightening us, especially when it comes to these global developments. We look at the No Kings protest. It brought millions to the streets on Saturday, suggests that the American people hate them even more. What does this mean now? My question is that could this mark a new American political posture?
Well, it's a great time to ask because on Saturday, nearly 7 million people in the U.S. were out in the streets. And this is an increase from the other No Kings mass protest day. That was in mid-June. You might remember it was Donald Trump's birthday, and he called a 250th sort of party for his army, a 250th birthday party for the U.S. Army. It was a damp squib. And the No Kings protest, in contrast, in the middle of June, really did surprise everyone because there were 2,000 separate locations. It's a big country, about 333 million people in the United States. To get 5 million that time and now nearly 7 million, nearly 2%, is an extraordinary achievement because it's an apathetic society. It's a society so deeply divided now where you've got this the insults that were being thrown around against the No Kings protesters, trying to relate them in some way to Hamas, in some way to extremism. In fact, it's a wide-ranging coalition that includes the old neoconservatives. A very few of them, I'm sure, were there. One of them is a very famous former national security advisor to Trump, John Bolton, and he hates Trump. And so that shows you one of the splits within the Make America Great Again and Republican Party movement, that is between the MAGA group and that's called the paleoconservative ideology and the neoconservatives, but also neoliberals, the classic Clinton administration and Obama administration democratic politicalists. And then you've also got people who are third worldists, who are promoting identity politics, who are promoting the ability of the United States now to sort of decline, hopefully in a graceful way. And then you've also got social democrats. I would put Bernie Sanders in that category, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, plus someone that I hope your listeners are aware of, probably the first Muslim mayor of New York when the election is held in a couple of weeks, and that's Zoran Mamdani. Mamdani actually grew up in Kampala and in Cape Town before moving to the U.S. at age 7. And then that network of sort of social democrats, I would add to that the broad left of the U.S., the independent left. It's a left that I personally know because that's where for about 25 years of my life I could feel comfortable. When I lived in the U.S., I was at university there. And it's a very interesting period because that left has been down and out, partly because since around 2009, when Barack Obama took power, the independent left was systematically suppressed so that when they did support Bernie Sanders, Sanders was completely denuded of power. He was, in a sense, sort of attacked by other Democrats, and Barack Obama led the attack in 2016 when really Bernie Sanders should have beaten Hillary Clinton to become the nominee. Probably would have been Trump, so there wouldn't have been a first term, much less a second term of Trump. And Sanders, again, was sort of pushed out in the 2000 primaries of the Democratic Party. Again, Obama's to blame. Now, those are the kinds of things that leave the U.S. left deeply divided between a neoliberal, a sort of conservative establishment wing, and the more vibrant activists. The latter, for example, would firmly support Palestine. The former would very actively support Israel, and that was the big split that led up, I think, to the defeat Kamala Harris in last November's election. Now, here's the most crucial point. You can keep building street protests, but the crucial power relations will be determined partly in the Congress. And so within just over a year and about 2 weeks, we're going to see the next big election, which is not the presidential, but it's the midterm election, where a third of the U.S. Senate and all of the U.S. House, that is the two branches of the U.S. Congress, the Parliament, they go up for election. And a third of the Senate may mean that the Republicans, who held a pretty strong 52-48, I say strong because it's often been 50-50, and that has been fraying, but it's been strong enough so that the Senate Republicans can defeat the Democrats, and especially with J.D. Vance, Vice President, acting as a senator, then there's a close vote. But secondly, the House itself, the 435 member, that may shift again. It's about an 8-seat Republican majority, and so there's a good chance that both the House and the Senate, or even just one of them, would swing, and that would then cause huge problems for the last 2 years of Trump's term. In fact, it's so frightening for him that there's even talk that he would somehow suspend, declare a state of emergency, create enough havoc in the next year that he wouldn't have to have midterm elections. He could continue just to rule with his current very powerful group, which is Republican, President Republican, Senate Republican, House of Representatives, and of course the Republican Supreme Court. And that's why the street heat, that is the ability to go out. And perhaps the next stage, as the Chicago mayor remarked, is to actually see what we've seen last week in Italy, a general strike. Everybody goes on strike, and that's where big business begins to get nervous. It really cuts away profits, makes the society ungovernable. And this is in the context, don't forget, where the whole government, with the exception of air traffic controllers and the army and the people they consider essential, are on furlough. They're not being paid, and they're not being allowed to come to work because there's a sort of a meltdown of government finance. It may be only a few more days before they sort it out, but Trump has refused to compromise with Democrats, and as a result, he's happy to see the U.S. state go into this paralysis where only the army works, and hopefully you can get through the customs and immigration if you're going in and out of the U.S., but it's, of course, ICE, which is the immigration police, they're working hard. That's a proto-fascist network of people trying to root out particularly Mexican immigrants. Now, when you put it all together, I can't tell you enough of this. This is a civil war. It's situation. And we've just seen a very peaceful protest on Saturday. There were no arrests of any of the 7 million or so protesters. There were 22 arrests of Trump counter demonstrators, which showed they were trying to get aggressive, and the police did arrest some pro-Trump people. So it's a fascinating time, isn't it, where you can ask the question, will the street heat, will people going out to protest be enough? Or will they have to withdraw their labor power on a workday, not a Saturday? And in fact, will they be able to do more than that by contesting for next year's election? But in the period between now and then, they're relying on the courts, they're relying on single-issue protests, they're making fun of Trump, comedians are still going wild, although, you know, there's a bit of censorship. The most popular, Stephen Colbert, had his show canceled. That'll take effect in May. And the other most popular, Jimmy Kimmel, had his show canceled, but there was such a backlash a few weeks ago that it was put back on the air. So you get a sense of the society really in the early stages of a full civil war. The Republicans, the American male, the sort of aggressive and sometimes racist white working class male, often with a gun, well, they could probably win just by virtue of their force of arms. But Trump himself isn't doing very, very well. The polls have him at between 41 and 44%, which is a very low level of popularity for a president. And the big question, can these protests continue to mount, and will it mean a shift perhaps to this next generation of young leftists like Zoran Mamdani, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who has Puerto Rican heritage, like Bernie Sanders, who's 82 years old, but really going strong, able to mobilize tens of thousands of these protests. So it's a fascinating time. We should learn a lot from it about the danger of a right-wing populism, that is the Trump MAGA, Make American Great Again movement of working class people who go right-wing when they're under threat. They may become especially xenophobic and Islamophobic and sexist and homophobic, transphobic. They may become, very culturally reactionary. They've taken away women, the reproductive rights, the right to an abortion. So they're moving quickly on the cultural front to cancel people that they don't like who are trying to have a more liberated lifestyle or simply have civil rights and freedom of expression. So that's what's at stake. And I think in this country, we should learn here in South Africa from the potential for a right-wing backlash. We're lucky. We've seen very little of that. But there could well, as we've seen with Operation Dudula and with the right-wing white population, who typically would be the business supporters, followers of Rob Herzog and his ilk. And that may be then the next comparative point where Donald Trump has seen people here in South Africa. He knows that the whites are subject to genocide. That's his ridiculous claim. He stopped making that claim, thank goodness. But he probably would give some support, as with Steve Bannon, to those right-wing forces like the Dula in the Gauteng and to some extent the Durban townships, but also the rich whites who want to have an escape town, to use the Cape Town for their escape from the rest of South Africa. And they want to have an independent Western Cape. They won't get it because the Constitution makes it very hard. But it's the kind of movement you can see where whites are getting a little bit more rebellious, and you'll see them out, you know, out and around in a more aggressive way, you know, egged on by Donald Trump and the likes of Rob Herzog.
Yeah. Now, in the main, Josh, in the main, what picture does this paint to the Trump administration?
Well, it's a mixed picture because all the promises made to his base are not coming true, by exception. That is, he is cracking down on immigration. That is, he's got a goal of getting rid of between 10 and 13 million people. Depends on who says what when. But his main immigration official is a man called Stephen Miller, and the head of the Homeland Security, who is a former governor of one of the Western states. She's a very, very aggressive, and she brags about shooting the puppy dog at one point. So those folks are still going strong, and they are violating people's rights. They are engaged in explicit racism by saying, you speak Spanish or you have brown skin, so we're going to lock you up, and you can prove later if you're an actual American citizen. And so that's going on at a very rapid rate. You can just imagine you're trying to get rid of 10 or 15 million people in a short period of time. So that's the most explicit way that Donald Trump has kept his campaign promise, which is that he would be very tough on immigration and undocumented workers. But on the other promises, such as inflation, he's failed. The inflation rate hasn't popped up as much as people had expected because of, you know, the tariffs that were going to be coming into effect. And I think that's one of the things where people are trying to figure out, is the lack of economic activity in the real economy in the U.S., the slowdown, the lack of job creation, it's all balanced by one huge danger, which is a huge bubble in the stock market. And those who've got some money in the stock market say, oh, I'm doing well because the AI, artificial intelligence stocks, are bubbling away. And there's big fear that, well, there's nothing much underneath in terms of, you know, the kind of classic bubbles that could burst any moment. It's, you know, that's sort of widely understood that the New York Stock Exchange and the other stock market, NASDAQ, are really very, very highly, like South Africans. South Africa is even more overvalued using what's called the Buffett indicator, that is market capitalization of our Johannesburg Stock Exchange divided by GDP, and the U.S. and South Africa at very high levels. And the bubble effect, certainly in a place like the United States, where it could pop out any time, as it's made clear, if the Chinese are following through with the threat to ban or to restrict the rare earth materials, which are very important as minerals for some of the AI applications, for batteries, for storage, for energy intensive activities. So let's say that the U.S. economy stands at a point where the inflation, the price increases haven't come down, the tariff increases, imported goods going up in price, the imports from South Africa by 30% for many of our goods, for some of them, like platinum and chrome, very important imports, gold, of course, into the U.S., those imports are at a 0% rating, but some of the others, like steel, aluminium, 25%, automobiles, 50%, those are going to be very hard hit. We've already seen huge declines in the shipments from South Africa, and then you'll see the same with the Chinese, which are also at the 30% level, Brazil and India at 50%. Those tariffs Trump did promise to put on, but he said we'd do that in a way that will create jobs, and there isn't any evidence yet that the fact that there are high tariffs on imports means you're going to get a lot of new investment. I haven't seen any evidence yet. It's a longer-term process, of course, but nobody's saying now because of tariffs I'm going to set up my own factory. And so we aren't seeing new jobs. We are seeing the inflation numbers in a period where Trump had said, no, we'll promise to cut prices. Well, he hasn't done that. And then the other extraordinarily dangerous things he's done, for example, ending U.S. aid, which is potentially disastrous for public health, which could bounce back if there's another pandemic like COVID. The climate walkout, again, terribly dangerous for the U.S., which is getting hard hit by climate emergencies, very, very extreme weather events, or the destruction of the Medicaid system, because you recall that the big accomplishment that Trump and his Republican Congress had a few weeks ago is to pass what he called the One Big Beautiful Bill, and that cut the corporate and elite, the top taxpayers, the richest people, cut their taxes, continuing on the Trump tax cuts from his first term. But it also cut about 14 million people from the medical aid system called Medicaid, and will make Medicare, that is health care for older people, much harder, because a lot of the clinics in rural areas and inner city areas that depend on Medicaid then are also supposed to be helping Medicare, the older people who need a little bit of health insurance. Now, those cuts are going to be, I think, most devastating in January and February when they really take effect. And then we'll, I think, see much more of a rebelliousness from within the base. And the final point to make on this, how is Trump doing? He's lost a lot of his support because instead of being that paleocon that I mentioned earlier, that is isolationist, staying out of other people's wars, trying not to impose democracy, as George W. Bush, his Republican predecessor, had tried to do. That is, I put democracy in scare quotes because we know what they really wanted when they invaded Iraq, which was oil. And so when they end their commitments in that way, as the MAGA people had expected, it may mean the need to cut back military. And that's another major factor for what the neoconservatives, the old guard in the military-industrial complex, in the State Department, the Pentagon, the think tanks, the media, they expect that Trump will actually continue the U.S. militaristic role. And that goes with not only the bombing of Iran, that is, they in June intervened to help Israel and to get a ceasefire between Israel and Iran by bombing some of Iran's nuclear facilities. We don't know how much advance warning, because the Iranians seem to be able to get the dangerous plutonium out before the U.S. hit two of the big bases where this was being I worked on the enhanced uranium. But then, in addition, we've seen Trump very aggressively engage in Ukraine, first by threatening the Ukrainian government with pulling out their support, and then by pulling out the support for Putin. So it's a zigzag. And currently, after what happened on Friday, that is, Trump met with the Prime Minister of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, and said, you have to accept that Putin has now captured about 20% of your country. You just have to accept that. And Zelensky stormed out. He was angry. He didn't accept that. And so the question of whether Trump will continue to back Ukraine remains, but particularly because Trump has said to India, if you keep buying Russian oil, we're going to have this 50% tariff. So the thing is very muddy when it comes to Ukraine. The only clear thing I can assure you of is that Trump is a hardcore Zionist who supports Israel down to the last bullet and what he hopes will be the last Palestinian. And that means that the grand vision he has, that is the Riviera of the Middle East, the clear away Gaza, kick out all of the Palestinians from Gaza, that remains in the back of his mind. Now, when we saw a couple of weeks ago that Trump seemed to be doing a deal for a ceasefire, we know in retrospect the last 10 days there's been no ceasefire. There's 40 people killed. So what we're seeing is Trump play everyone, make grandiose claims. He really had hoped he would win the Nobel Peace Prize about 9 days ago. He didn't do that. The Venezuelan right-wing leader did. But the main point about all this is that Trump and Netanyahu retained their friendship, and whatever little tussles they had going back and forth, that's faded away, and the fate of the Palestinians still is in question, because even though the hostages, the Hamas has released them, 20 living hostages, looking for the bodies of the other dead hostages, really killed by Israel in those bombs, it's pretty clear Hamas is not ready to give up, that many of the tunnels underneath Gaza are still intact. Their weaponry is still strong. They can, if they go back to fighting, the Israelis never stop, but Hamas has put a pause. Well, they can still do a lot of damage to Israel, so we could see a restart. But of course, the most terrible thing is that dozens, hundreds of Palestinians die. The food shipments aren't coming in. The potential for rebuilding, the obvious debt that Israel owes to Palestine, huge crisis, debt for killing tens and tens of thousands, many more than 60,000 we know dead, maybe tens of thousands more under this rubble. But particularly that the refusal by Israel to see what we all know they should see, that is a UN resolution that Palestinians have the right to return. There should be no discrimination of Palestinians in Israel and no further occupation of occupied Palestine. Those are the three demands made by the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And I think the last point to make is, in the U.S., it's still a strong movement, not nearly as strong as it was about a year and a half ago when the college kids were out. They were intimidated in the period since. It's a strong movement for boycott, divestment, sanctions. But, of course, we see that here in South Africa, because with Colombia having stopped the coal sales, the number one merchant of coal to run 20% of Israel's grid has been the Colombian coal mines going through Glencore and an American company, Drummond. And now Glencore and its partner here, African Rainbow Minerals, still being part and parcel of the supply of coal. In fact, South Africa now the number one coal supplier. There are three ships, two that are on the ocean right now, going from Richards Bay up to Hedera, one actually docked in Hedera, the main port, Hedera and Ashkelon, the two main ports where coal is unloaded. One just docked in October 1. So we're really very shameful, I think, that South Africa hasn't and address the deep hypocrisy that the President Ramaphosa's brother-in-law, Patrice Motsepe, running African Rainbow Minerals, in spite of protests at his office, in spite of several protests at Glencore office, we still haven't got the strength of the base to try to correct for what the Trump-Netanyahu project, that is letting Israel stand over Gaza and powering that project with South African coal, that huge hypocrisy, that huge embarrassment to us. So I think we're all implicated in this, but most importantly, I think we need to learn, like the Madagascar activists last week, like people in Morocco the week before, Tunisia a couple of weeks before that, and Kenya, that people can write their own history and protest from below and make a new society.
Yeah, absolutely.
Prof, I think we'll make some time to delve much into the Madagascar. So we're just running out of time, but hopefully we make another time. I think it's important that we touch base on the Madagascar issue. But thank you so much for your insights at this moment, Prof. I really appreciate your time.
Always great to be here. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure indeed. A very big thank you there to our guest, Professor Patrick Bond, Distinguished Professor of Sociology and Political Economist at the University of Johannesburg. It's 12:30 p.m. Central African Time.
Marcus Sahaba Online Radio, serving you wherever you are.